I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, on December 25th, Christmas Day 2020, Anthony Quinn Warner went to downtown Nashville and set off an RV bomb, killing himself, injuring eight others, and causing much damage to buildings in the surrounding area. This incident has since gone down the memory hole, perhaps in part due to the shocking events of January 6th, 2021, namely the storming of the U.S. Capitol by pro-Trump elements like QAnon and Stop the Steal. Our guest on this edition of the program, however, thinks that it deserves more consideration and raises some rather unnerving questions. Steve O'Keefe is the author of a recent piece in Counterpunch Plus entitled The Nashville Bombing: More Than Meets the Eye. O'Keefe is in the position to offer a unique perspective due to his having worked for the controversial publisher Lunpanics Unlimited. For the uninitiated, Lunpanics specialized in the publication and sale of books on taboo topics, including, perhaps most infamously, how-to guides for illicit activities such as methamphetamine manufacture, the creation of counterfeit IDs, and do-it-yourself bomb making. That last one, of course, is the kicker for the conversation to follow. Having worked on many books about bombs, O'Keefe has a few things to say about the events of December 25th, 2020 in Nashville. A fascinating conversation that raises some unnerving questions. With that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Steve O'Keefe, former employee of Lunpanics Unlimited. Welcome to Parallax Views, Steve O'Keefe of Ouroboros. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Jay.
So if you could, Steve, first off, tell my listeners about your company, Ouroboros, and then we'll explain why you're on the show and what we're going to discuss.
Yeah, Ouroboros is basically a book PR company. So I've been doing online PR for book publishers and authors since about 94 when I left the company Lunpanics, a book publisher that we'll get into a little bit later. I was at Lunpanics from 1983 to 1994, and then I started promoting books on the internet in 1994, and I've been doing that in some fashion ever since.
So for my listeners, the reason I wanted to have you on the show is you have an article out at Counterpunch Plus entitled The Nashville Bombing: More Than Meets the Eye. You mentioned Lunpanics. That sort of gives you maybe a different kind of insight into the Nashville bombing. That it already seems like it's been memory-holed in some ways. But maybe we should start with what Loom Panics was and why you wrote this article.
Well, Loom Panics is a notorious publisher and seller of unusual books. That was their slogan, publishers and sellers of the world's most controversial and unusual books. And they started in Michigan in the 1970s with just like a list of about 12 books. And then they moved out to Washington State in the early 1980s. And I joined them in 83 and as a typesetter initially, worked my way up to the editorial director there. And the sorts of books Loom Panics, both, they were both publishers and sellers. So not all the books that they sold were ones they published, and their catalog had like 500 books in it that were just exotic as all get out. And I, the catalog, a lot of people will remember this as an artifact from the 80s and 90s, this Loom Panics catalog. It's about a half inch thick. And just the categories of the books that they sold will give you an idea of what kind of stuff. They had 12 pages in the catalog of books on fake ID, for example, how to make fake ID and use it. Books on avoiding taxes, the underground economy, hiding things, privacy, books on conducting investigations, police investigations, missing persons investigations, books on revenge. They had a book called Screw the Bitch, Divorce for Tactics for Men. Politically, everything they did was politically incorrect. That was sort of the brand. They had books on guns, making your own guns, making your own silencers, homemade silencers. They had books on explosives, kitchen improvised plastic explosives. And they had books on all kinds of exotic weapons. In fact, the owner of the company, Michael Hoy, my boss, the publisher, he was the author of their book on exotic weapons, which he was very proud that you could buy every weapon that was listed in this book. And they were things like nunchucks and crossbows and just very intriguing weapons, and with information about the companies that made them or how you could buy them or where you could buy them. So he was sort of into strange and unusual weapons. He was a Vietnam War veteran himself. Far from being like a nutcase or a PTSD, you know, time bomb waiting to go off, if you saw pictures of him or met him in person, you'd think he was the most mild-mannered, accounting-looking type of guy. You could not imagine that he was running this company. But he loved crazy science fiction. He loved indie comics. He was a collector of a lot of indie comic art, and he liked things that shook up consensus reality. And so some of the other books, guerrilla warfare, things on murder, death, and torture, books on hiding in the hills, surviving in the hills, making your own shelters, health and life extension. He had a big library of life extension books way early. You couldn't buy these books in stores, obviously, a lot of the scarier titles, but even he had books on growing weed and making LSD and making crank and secrets of methamphetamine manufacture.
Uncle Fester.
Yes, Uncle Fester, one of their best-selling titles there. Also, books on increasing your intelligence, science, heresy, anarchism and egoism, creating your own reality, and self-publishing. So a very eclectic list of stuff that was primarily stuff that was off, off the beaten path. And so how I got onto the Nashville bombing was I've edited a lot of these books. And there was something about the Nashville bombing that didn't add up, which is the explosive power of an individual with the amount of explosives that you could conceivably put into an RV. So if you pack that RV with ammonium nitrate, which was the material used in the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, it could not, it's unlikely it would have caused anything near that size of an explosion. So you're either dealing with an explosive that people can't normally buy, or something's going on there. How does it happen? Okay, so if you got an explosive that no one can reasonably buy, how did they buy it? This person should have been under surveillance, even if they were buying ammonium nitrate in the quantities that could fill that RV. And when you look at it, his girlfriend, maybe disgruntled or whatever, told the police he's building bombs in his RV. I mean, she was very specific about where and what. And the police went to his home, and when they knocked on the door, his attorney answered the door. So he was apparently expecting this, or I don't know whether he lives with his attorney or something, but it's very unusual for a suspect to have their attorney at the door when the cops knock. So they refused him entry. Now, they could have gotten a search warrant for the RV. It sounds like the RV was in the yard when the cops came to talk to him. And yet they didn't come back with a search warrant. They didn't wait till they got a search warrant. And they just let that go. Now, that was one mistake. The other is then if he's buying stuff that's either a high explosive or large quantity of explosive, that should have set off some bells and whistles somewhere. Other things that should have come to people's attention is practice. You can't set off a bomb without knowing how to set off a detonator. And then practicing the detonation usually happens out in the woods someplace when people are doing this. And they're often noticed setting off explosives in the woods as they try to figure out how to build a bomb. And so they come to the attention of the authorities either because of practicing or injuring themselves practicing or because of their purchases or because of their statements about I'm going to blow the fucking place up, you know, something like that might bring them to the attention of the authorities. So here we have if a lone individual disgruntled with their life, which appears to be what happened through packets that were mailed. Like very often I was at, when I'm listening, my daughter lives in Nashville. So I had a keen interest in just following the story when I heard it. And the first clue that I got that something wasn't right was when a forensics expert on just a local news program covering it mentioned that the fireball was unusually bright and large for an explosion that created as little crater as it did. So he suspected an accelerant on it, which would be a high explosive thing. And he thought if it was an ammonium nitrate, it wouldn't have had that fireball, and it would have had a bigger crater under it, I believe is what he said. So it struck me that this explosive, as I thought, you know, you can't do this with an RV. You cannot do this with an RV bomb, as far as I know, from all these books. Now, look, I'm telling you, dozens of books on explosives, bombs, etc.
There's one you mentioned in the article, too. I think it's Basement Nukes.
Basement Nukes. Now, Basement Nukes is not a book on building basement nukes, but it is a book from Lumpanics about the consequences of what happens when people can build very deadly things in very small packages. It's a great book by the same guy who wrote How to Start Your Own Country. That's a Lumpanics book, Erwin S. Strauss, and which is a true guide to a couple of hundred countries that were formed over the past couple of hundred years. So really a kind of amazing guide on how a case histories of people trying to start their own countries, even from their own bedroom. This is the kind of crazy stuff you get at Lumpanix, which is just, I love it. And so The Basement Nukes wasn't about that, but we did have books on making explosives, making pipe bombs, and
anarchist cookbook and poor man's James Bond type stuff.
Right. And those were both books we sold, not ones we published. I'm trying to, in my mind, that's a division. Maybe in your mind, it doesn't make a difference. But yes, Anarchist Cookbook was notorious. Everybody sort of knows about that. And the recipes in there will get you blown up if you try to follow them. They're not good. If you follow their bomb making stuff, you're more likely to blow off your hand than you are to carry out any sort of even an entertaining weekend out in the woods blowing things up, you know. So the idea of somebody creating a bomb of that size without coming to the attention of authorities and being able to actually pull it off, it's really hard to pull off making those things go off properly. And it sounds like he had both a detonator and a timer on it. So the detonator is a tricky and a problem, usually has to be tested. A timer just adds to the complexity. And so it's actually can be very hard to get a bomb to go off. You can shoot at an RV that's full of ammonium nitrate with a gun and it's not going to blow up. So you have to know what the heck you're doing, both to build a detonator and to build a timer. And if you have both, it's unimaginable that you could do that without significant practice or training. He hasn't been trained as a pyrotechnics in the military or anything like that. There's nothing in his background that indicates that he has the technical capabilities of a master bomber, say somebody in a terrorist organization or somebody who's studied bomb making.
If I could real quick, I think a key point here is, so these types of books that we were talking about, I mentioned Poor Man's James Bond by Kurt Saxon, the Anarchist Cookbook, or even if we're talking about previous bombers, like say Ted Kaczynski, it sounds like that is much less sophisticated than what the Nashville bomber did.
Well, it would be if that's how it happened. Now, since I've published this article, I've come across some additional information. Are you interested in that? Okay, a friend of mine, Ken McCarthy, who I had no idea was also disturbed by the explosive power of a single individual with an RV, began looking into it. And of course, the placement of the RV next to the AT&T building is the major significant clue in the case. There's a reason that that thing was parked next to AT&T. Now it turns out that when you have backup power supply systems for communication systems, and the AT&T building there was a emergency power supply, backups, power supply, communications network for much of the Southeast, they have a tendency to off hydrogen gas. Now, that's usually not a problem. It's ventilated. It's not a problem if it just ventilates out into the air. It can be a problem if it builds up. And there have been explosions in communications facilities with large backup battery storage operations where hydrogen built up to an excessive level and blew. And the explosion is similar to the one that you see in Nashville, in that it is a lot of flash. It's really fast. The accelerant of compressed hydrogen gas, it's like it'd be like putting a a truck full of those, acetylene torch oxygen canisters, right next to a building and setting it off. It's just a big, fast boom. So Ken, his theory was that the guy in the RV was just unlucky, had parked there and got blown up by a industrial accident at the AT&T building. But I think there's ample evidence to show that the guy in the RV most likely knew of the hydrogen gas buildup at the AT&T facility because he was an internet communications specialist. So he may have been in that building before. He may very well have known people that worked at AT&T. He may have well known that this is a potential problem for buildings like that, is hydrogen buildup. And so it's possible, it's very likely that he did have a bomb and he did blow himself up. But it's also very likely, I believe, that that bomb was a little bomb and he attached it to the building, the AT&T building, which made it a big bomb. And so when his little bomb blew, the hydrogen inside the AT&T building blew, which he knew would go out. And that's why the enormous blast. So it's still a disturbing incident that a lone individual who does not come on the radar of law enforcement is able to build a little bomb and drive it next to a big bomb and let it go.
Right. And I think he injured 8 people, damaged dozens of buildings in the surrounding area of downtown Nashville, and, died in the process. So for listeners, the bomber was Anthony Quinn Warner, just to give some background. Mm-hmm. You can add anything from there.
Not only that, but it appears that his beloved dogs also perished in the RV at the time that he killed himself. He killed his pets, too. So other details about the bombing were that he had the song Downtown playing in between a recorded message to leave the area. And further investigation on that shows that it's most likely that the song Downtown was playing on a outdoor speaker from a nearby building and not from the RV, but the RV was possibly just playing the recorded message to get out of the area. Now, Ken McCarthy thinks the recorded message to leave the area may have been coming from the AT&T building, because if there was a problem with hydrogen buildup, they have alarm systems that go off and they would say stuff like, you must leave the area immediately, an explosion is about to happen. But the problem is that in the hearing of the recording that I've heard, it mentions the vehicle, like, do not approach the vehicle. Well, that wouldn't be on a recording inside the AT&T building if it was a warning system for their hydrogen gas off flow. So I do believe that he did have a warning attached to the RV, that he did have a bomb in the RV. And from the packages, he sent out packages. Most people who perform actions like this want to make sure that they get proper credit. And they often send mailings on the day or the day before they do this kind of an action, to ensure that they don't get forgotten or obliterated. And indeed, he did send packages to about 8 people, I think they've identified so far. Only one news place has revealed some of the contents of those packages. And those are the ones that say that he had a belief in lizard people. And that he was possibly QAnon, but I haven't seen anything that said he was QAnon, but I have seen stuff that he talks about people being lizards. And I'm not exactly sure they don't give enough for me to know what the heck he's talking about with the lizard people. But it reminds me of the, you know, the They Live movie. Do you know that movie?
I love They Live, and it reminds me of V. Do you remember V?
Yeah, V also is like that. And so maybe he had a feeling for lizard people or something, but I'd sure like to see what was in that packet, because I'm guessing he's going to explain what he did in there, but they maybe don't want people to know what he did. Maybe they don't want people to know that this vulnerability exists in these telecommunications facilities. I don't know why it is the most tight-lipped I've ever seen on any kind of, you can't imagine an urban disaster that has less information being given to the people about what happened.
I was going to say, I keep telling people, I feel like this Nashville bombing that happened on Christmas, it's gone down the memory hole. It's almost like everyone just forgot about it like a week after it happened.
Yeah, because if you can take a pissed off 65-year-old white guy, and I'm sorry, I'm mentioning he's white because of that, the cops let him go on the girlfriend saying he's making the bombs in the RV. I mean, that sounds like a little bit like white privilege to me. But also, if you're, I'm a guy that could fit that profile of these people, and if you think anyone like that could just get in the old RV, pack it up with a few bales of ammonium nitrate and then go downtown, this would be happening all over the country. It could be a plague, and so they need to know whether somebody can actually build a bomb that big in an RV, or whether it's this these facilities that have these incredible, it'd be like Beirut, where they're storing all that ammonium nitrate, and then one day somebody walks by and it goes off. If all of the telecommunications facilities with backup emergency power supplies in the U.S. are hydrogen bombs waiting to go off, and they're in packed urban centers, downtown cores, don't you think people should know about that?
In other words, someone clever enough could exploit what's in these facilities.
Oh, yes. It could absolutely now be a new target for terrorists if they know that they can just, with a little bomb that they can make in a suitcase, that they could set a hydrogen bomb in motion at a 10-story building and take out a whole couple of blocks in the neighborhood. Boy, that is something that the American people anywhere really has to know, how such an explosive capability could be triggered by a lone, disgruntled individual that is not on law enforcement radar. It's just really, it's kind of like amazing.
Yeah, I wanted to clarify something, because I think people will look at the headline of the article, the Nashville bombing, more than meets the eye, and then they maybe read a line like, let me see if I can find it. Hold on one second. Ah, here it is. We're supposed to believe that a single disgruntled individual built a mobile bomb capable of taking out a city block in the back of an old RV, and nobody saw him building it or practicing or stockpiling explosives? I think some people, when they read that, they may start misinterpreting and thinking, is he saying that there was more than one person, that there was some kind of conspiracy? And I don't know. What are you trying to say in that regard?
What I'm trying to say is just that this doesn't add up. So my whole piece was really about, this doesn't add up. And, for a person shouldn't be able to take out that kind of real estate without coming to the attention of the authorities, or without a big plan. McVeigh in Oklahoma City bombing, there were a lot of people involved in that, and they had a big vehicle, and it was packed with a lot of explosives. And, yes, with a big plan, or with people who are trained in explosives, you can have this kind of thing. But it just didn't make any sense for a lone individual to be able to do that. Now, it's possible that there are co-conspirators that are not known, but they might not be the ones that provided explosives. They might be the ones that told them that the hydrogen buildup is in the building. I mean, somebody had to, if that's the case, somebody had to let him know that it was there, that there was a thing there that he could trigger. He didn't figure that out himself. I guarantee you, he didn't figure that all out himself. And if he did, you know, what was he doing? I mean, he'd be really a Unabomber type genius. And like when you got to the background of the Unabomber, indeed, you find out that he's a very, very, very smart person. I mean, he's got a high IQ and a lot of education. And but this guy in Nashville is not, he's no Unabomber. And so, it just doesn't make sense that he could have that kind of explosive power with one person. And it may be true that he had help from somebody on the inside who told him about this vulnerability or weakness. Okay, and then he took it out. So,
because I know you also said the ability of a lone individual untrained in military pyrotechnics to successfully build, move, and detonate a device the size of the Nashville Christmas bomb should be unnerving to every American. So I felt like there was also something that you were saying about, you know, lone wolf terrorism. It seems like it can be even more dangerous than it was a few decades ago.
Yes, if this is true, that he built such an explosive bomb and an RV by himself without detection, then it takes the lone wolf lethality up an order of magnitude. It makes the lone wolf a much, much bigger problem for the United States than they ever could have imagined before, because it's conspiracies of people that cause the plots to be discovered. And with no conspiracy, with no co-plotters, no triggering of buying restrictions. I mean, maybe there's something that they didn't look at that they have to restrict, but now I don't believe that that's true. I don't believe that he actually did build a super bomb by himself. I believe he built a small conventional bomb and attached it to a big bomb of an AT&T facility with pent-up hydrogen gas. I think, you know, again, I only that information came to light after I published it, which is a good reason why to publish in Counterpunch, and a good thing that people are reading, because that brought this other theory to my attention, which I think has problems because they don't acknowledge that the bomber sent these packets out and basically told people he was going to do this and then did it, you know. If you put those two things together, a small bomb planted next to a hydrogen facility, then you get a different story. And now, you know, you either have to take care on these facilities and guard them in some fashion, or, you know, we could be faced with this happening quite frequently if they don't take measures to either put whatever explosives that was on a list that's watched, or put those facilities on notice that they have to like move out of dense urban areas.
So do you think it's possible that this was a completely lone individual type incident?
Yes, I do. I believe, well, except that someone had to tell him about this hydrogen thing. I don't think that's common knowledge. Now that we've done research on it, we can find instances where this has happened, where facilities have blown up in very dramatic ways because of hydrogen buildups. So it's not a crazy theory, but it still is. It is very clever on his part if he thought this through and pulled it off, and it actually worked. I mean, the bomb in the truck worked, and the bomb in the building worked, and the whole thing worked together. And, you know, sometimes people just are lucky that way. I mean, I don't consider it to be, you know, good luck, but I mean, that things just happen that, you couldn't have imagined. Like, do you think that the 9/11 hijackers, do you think they knew the buildings were going to burn down or crumble down or melt down? I don't think they knew that. I don't think they had any idea that those buildings would basically implode or crumble. That was just like surprise to everybody, I think. So he may have been very well have been surprised if he had lived long enough to see what happened, that it worked.
Could you elaborate as well on what is it that has led to this case sort of being, you know, pushed to the side? I mean, I know that's speculative, but it seems like, I said earlier, there's not much discussion of this anymore. It seems like there hasn't been much follow-up reporting on it.
I think the feds are afraid of both sides of this, because at Loon Panics, when bad things happen, we got visited by the feds. So, you know, when they were looking for somebody and they knew that that person had our books, they would come to the office and they would ask to see our database to see if they could find a new address or something for this person. And we only had to, we never had to let them see the database, which is nice, or have a fishing expedition. They were only allowed to get information on the specific names that they requested, and only with a court order. So I think if my understanding of this, by the way that they've handled other issues, is they're afraid of it. They're afraid of it because this guy didn't come to their attention. I mean, he actually briefly did, but they still would have had no idea of the scope of his plan if they caught him making little bombs in his, like, little Molotov cocktails or something in his RV out back. You know, they probably wouldn't have thought too much about that, especially rural Tennessee. You know, that's a God-given right to go blow something up on your back 40. So people there do play with explosives and guns a lot, and they're allowed to. And so, you know, I think they're concerned because they too could not have imagined that one person that wasn't part of a network or that wasn't trained as a military or a terrorist, and, you know, just basically a fairly ordinary person, a citizen, as they might be called, could do something that could have that kind of explosive impact. And, you know, a similar type of situation might occur, like if he drove the truck over to a gas station and set it off there, it might not even blow up the gas station, because those gas tanks are concrete reinforced bunkers. And they won't go off if a car explodes in the gas station. The storage tanks will not explode because they're hardened for that. But apparently, whatever it was he tapped into, which I now believe is the more likely theory, is that he tapped into a big bomb inside the building. Whatever he tapped into was not hardened enough to take the small explosive from the RV without also detonating. And so that takes cleverness. And if that's cleverness, you know, they're going to want to find out if that cleverness was, if he was tipped to that, like if there is like some network that's telling people, you know, go put a bomb next to AT&T and you'll knock out the G5 and you'll save the world or something, you know, because there is a lot of, the cops have not said yet that there was anything anti-G5 in the packet. And or 5G, I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. But there is a movement that is anti-5G, and they have done sabotage and malicious vandalism to towers. But I'm, you know, there's no sense that, and The mind would love to connect him with 5G, with AT&T. It would somehow be poetic, but I haven't seen anything yet that connects that. But if it turns out there are a network of like 5G people and they have figured this thing out and are spreading this information, this how-to information around, that would be extremely dangerous. You'd wanna tap into that. And I think just the idea that urban centers have these repositories of explosive materials that are not watched or guarded. And it makes it seem like any city could be Beirut one day when the wrong person rocks by the wrong storage facility and all of a sudden it's like big bomb time. And so if these hazards are in densely populated areas, they really need to be moved. There's no reason for them to be, to any longer be in downtown cores. You know, if you look at that building in Nashville, it didn't fit in with the environment. It wasn't particularly historic. It was just a, most of these buildings have no windows on them. So they're naturally unappealing looking. and they're often quite tall, 8 or 10 stories. And they just look like ugly boxes. And they often have very few people that work there. So they are almost operate by sensors and remote controls. So it could so be that.
Essentially, it means we're, you know, there's a level of insecurity if this all went down the way we're told it was, that is probably frightening to everyone, including federal agencies.
Yes, as far as I can tell, there's no good scenario to come out of this, which is maybe why they won't talk to us at all about what they found there. Like Ken McCarthy's beyond himself by the fact that they won't discuss the explosives used, and no one has mentioned any trace of any explosive yet. And there's a lot of now confusing information about whether the recording that was playing was really coming out of the RV and whether the RV was booby-trapped or not. It would be nice if they would be more forthcoming with the American people about what happened and why.
Now, it's interesting. There's a very small portion of the article where you mentioned this idea of asymmetrical warfare. What is asymmetrical warfare, and why do you mention it? Because I think it's important to know, if one guy could do this, a small group of people engaging in asymmetrical warfare can do this as well.
Yes, and this takes us back to the Loon Panic's book, Basement Nukes, The Consequences of Weapons, Cheap Weapons of Mass Destruction. And asymmetrical warfare basically is the ability of a small, unfunded group of people to exact disproportionate losses on the part of the opponent. Well-armed, well-equipped opponent. So that's the asymmetry, is that it's basically David versus Goliath. And the recent example of this that really scares the heck out of all dictators and all, you know, really all leaders of countries is the Houthi rebels using less than $100,000 worth of drones to attack a Saudi oil facility and inflict $500 million worth of damage to that facility. And the drones were able to get past, the U.S. had, I believe, Patriot missiles there. So that they were ready for incoming missiles. They were not ready for incoming drones. And the drones were a lot easier to buy, make, and deploy, and a lot cheaper than it would have been to launch missiles. And so it's there are clever ways to find the Achilles heel of systems and then attack that Achilles heel in a way that can bring down the entire system. And unfortunately, the increasing complexity of systems in modern technological societies, they become increasingly vulnerable to very small defects causing very large problems. You know, somebody tries to upload something in a recursive manner, and next thing you know, the whole internet's down in the Northeast corridor or something like that. So the ability of terrorist groups to exploit those weaknesses lead to things like 9/11 and like the Houthi attack on Saudi Arabia. And if this is true, a lone individual being able to take out two city blocks like that is completely asymmetrical warfare and would be a terribly frightening increase in the level of lethality of the lone wolf.
It would be unprecedented.
Yes. It would, and I suspect that may be why we haven't heard so much about this yet, is it's a little bit chilling. I'm sure if all of these facilities are now suspect, they don't want to maybe have that information publicly available just yet. So
now I was going to add one interesting part of this article is I think everyone's been focusing on the January 6th storming of the Capitol. And you make note of that, saying that you feel like there's something even more frightening about the Nashville bombing. What do you make of the Capitol 6 riot? And I think you even linked to an article about a Capitol rioter who had bomb making manuals.
Yes. Typical story when I used to work at Lumpanics is they'd find our books at the last known address of some creep, and we'd get a phone call, you know, looking for a new address.
Wasn't there a famous case of that with the, I think there was a book about how to be a contract hitman?
That's right. The hitman case was a book published by Paladin Press, and somebody followed the instructions in it quite to the T, even though it was just for entertainment purposes and an entertaining story. So the relatives of the person who was murdered sued Paladin Press for putting out this manual on how to be a contract killer. And it never went to the Supreme Court. It got up to a certain level, and Paladin Press's insurance company settled, so the free speech elements of it never got a chance to be heard. But they have been heard in other cases where people have died on like movie sets and or someone killed someone because they saw the Joker, you know, or other movies, and or said that or imitated something in that. Or Clockwork Orange even had that issue when it came out, that movie a long time ago, the Stanley Kubrick one. So these cases all have lost when they've gotten to the Supreme Court. You can't blame the movie theater or the book publisher for telling you a tale that then inspires you to do something nefarious. And that's what I liked about Lumpanics. It really was just ink on paper. It was just words. And people get themselves so bent up out of shape about these words. And really, a lot of their most heinous manuals came from the United States government. Like, they had one called Physical Interrogation Techniques, which was a book on torture. And it was supposedly a former Army field manual. And, you know, everybody at Lumpanics revolted over that book. Typesetter refused to typeset it. The editor refused to edit it. I refused to market it. So the boss had to do the entire job himself. Some 14 printers refused to print it. And he typeset the thing, he proofread the thing, he edited it, and finally got it printed somehow. And it's just a terrible book, but nonetheless, he has the right to publish that. So
I was going to ask about that. Would you still defend Lupanics and what they published? It sounds like you would.
Oh, absolutely. I would still defend it, but you would expect that because, you know, I have a long history with them, so I'm in deep. But I still would defend that today. I do think today that they would be canceled, that they would not be allowed to say anything on Twitter anymore or Facebook or LinkedIn or any of that. They were canceled early and often. So, you know, I heard all this hypocrisy from independent bookstores about, oh, you know, Barnes & Noble is going to wipe out independent publishers and we won't get a diversity of points of view. But none of these independent bookstores wanted to touch our stuff with a 10-foot pole. So it was very few. And Barnes & Noble's would stock our stuff. And so partly because they had to fill up that huge amount of space with some inventory. And so we often had problems with censorship then. Our books weren't allowed in Canada very often. And so I don't think censoring words on paper is a good idea ever. Or I'm really not in favor of censoring any images either. And I wouldn't show stuff to my kids. But today, you know, defense attorneys for former President Donald Trump presented evidence in a Senate impeachment hearing where they showed the kind of graphic images that would have gotten anybody else kicked off the air. I could not believe that they showed images of people being killed, images of people being beat up. And these are the kinds of things that even news organizations are not allowed to put on. So, you know, if there's going to be censorship, it's just a lot of hypocrisy, I think, you know, and it's also hypocrisy to kill thousands of people in wars and then, you know, not be allowed to talk about it or how they did it or why they did it. So
in that regard, what do you think the value of Lupanics was? I know it doesn't exist anymore, but what would you say the value of its publishing was?
Well, people called us the canary in the coal mine. They knew that if Lupanics got taken down, that was the end of free speech, you know. And Lupanics never did get taken down. Amazon took them down because these books became no longer controversial or unusual or hard to find. The whole mail order book business sort of just dried up. And the funny thing is then once it dried up, then Amazon started taking them down. So the cancel culture is back after all. And now it's very, very hard to find some of these books. And I can't believe the prices that some of them command. So
I was going to add though, at the same time, in a way, they've become more easily accessible. I'm assuming, for instance, you referenced this article, Capital writer Dominic Pizzola had bomb-making manuals, prosecutors say, and that was in the New York Post on the 29th of January. A lot of these books are now available, you know, through torrent websites, PDFs, and, you know, I don't think taking down Lupanics has stopped these books from getting into people's hands, especially in the age of the internet.
Oh, no. You know, information wants to be free is what they say. And the internet is the great bastion of free information and also just a lot of bad information. And that's par for the course. You know, I'd say a lot of those PDFs that you might find online with instructions might easily get you blown up or might get you followed or put on a list somehow. Or you know, just be careful what you're looking at. And I appreciate people like Julian Assange and Eric Snowden and folks that have revealed these secrets. Loon Panics was very much about not letting them keep their techniques to themselves, you know, letting everybody see how the state operates in all of its glory and horror in all spheres. And so we would show, like, we had all these books on wiretapping, and in Canada, you couldn't sell those books. They were okay with books on bombs, guns, torture, rape, you know, but not wiretapping. You know, that just crossed the line somehow. Whereas in the U.S., they were fine about books on wiretapping, you know. The books that they got their nose in a joint most about were books about how to evade taxes, tax evasion books. They didn't like us. We published the IRS's field manual at one time because any document published by the United States is public domain. And so we were allowed legally to publish it, which is how the auditors looked at that for when they were doing audits for what to look for. And they really got upset on that. They came at us big time on that. The insurance company ended up settling something on that score. But yeah, the U.S. money is what they care about. And I felt like the best book, the most subversive book that we published there was a book called Counterfeit Currency, How to Really Make Money. And it was a book by a disgruntled U.S. Treasury employee, as far as we've been told, and with very, very good detailed instructions of how to make fake money. And I thought nothing showed more that the whole phoniness of, you know, our Western civilization and the fact that, you know, money is just nothing but just a printing. It's a print job, you know.
It's interesting.
It's like any other print job.
I was going to say it's interesting, too, because it sounds like they were more concerned about books like that than they were any of the books about bombs and guns.
Yeah, I think the bombs and gun stuff, well, a lot of the people working for the state like those books. So a lot of our customers for those books were people who were military, active duty, former duty, or, you know, had some sort of connection. And it was really, you know, I would say the books that we sold like that were sort of amateurish. You could build something, but you weren't going to, you know, really lead an army with this kind of equipment or these sort of bombs. They're good for a one-time bang, you know, of some sort, you know, little bang, big bang, but they're not the kind of thing that really upset them the way books about, you know, things that might like how to make fake passports. You know, they don't, some of our fake ID books they were okay with, but other ones they had a bit of a problem with. So.
In other words, I guess the books on maybe bombs and guns, it's not like they could be really used for like a giant like McVeigh type operation.
Yeah, that's right. And whereas books on ID and books on currency and things, those could be those could create serious problems, you know.
Before we close out here, the one last thing I wanted to touch upon about Loon Panics, I mean, it was a huge part of, I guess, that sort of underground culture of the 80s and 90s. You know, there were also other publishers out there like Feral House and Disinfo that were sort of part of that sort of counterculture of the time. I'm curious, you mentioned Mike Hoy, Loon Panics. What was the sort of politics? Because I think there's been people that have tried to claim the mantle of Loon Panics, sort of these, I know there's a few alt-right figures that have started publications saying that they're the heirs to Loon Panics. And I really don't think that Loon Panics necessarily shared their politics any more than they shared the politics of maybe some people on the left. I feel like Loon Panics almost existed in its own political space.
Well, it was really, I felt broad-minded in that they sold books that offended people on the left and the right and every stripe. So all of our, something in our catalog would offend someone. But at the time, a lot of the books that we published were a little bit different than the books that we sold. And the books that we published did tend more towards anarchism and political and theory like that. And some of them were really seminal. Like we published Bob Black's The Abolition of Work, which was just a major breakthrough, I think, in terms of left theory. And we published Vanu, The Search for Invulnerability by a guy named Rayo, which is basically how to live in the woods free from the bludge, as he called it. And Rayo was really the predecessor for Taz. Taz was published in New York by Autana Media. And Taz really, you know, turned the page, the temporary autonomous zone by Hakim Bey. And that book showed how you could live free inside of the belly of the beast. And a lot of Lumpanic's books were about how you can live free even though you're in tyranny or some form of that. You can still live free. What I don't like today in these riots at the Capitol is, you know, the survivalists, they were just wanted to be left alone. They didn't want to run things. No, I don't know anyone who wants to run things. So why take over? Why not just learn to live free on your own?
Yeah, I was going to say even libertarian authors at Lumpanics like Claire Wolf seem like a very different kettle of fish than these Capitol rioters.
Yes, and I would say, you know, we did have obviously a lot of stuff on weapons, and that was a different era. After the Vietnam War, there are a lot of people who knew how to use weapons around. You know, weapons were much more part of the culture than they are now. So, in terms of people being trained to use them and using them to hunt, for example, hunting has gone way, way down. People don't really hunt like they used to, but Lumpanics would have gone, you know, here's how you can hunt and skin your animals and be your own backwoods doctor. And, you know, they provided the tools in terms of the literature anyway, for people to live free.
I was going to just add to that. I mean, it's interesting even reading some of Mike Hoy's views. He definitely didn't engender himself to libertarians at times, because he would complain about corporations. So Lumpanics, I think, held a very interesting space. And I also think, would it be fair to say that they come from a sort of individualist anarchist sort of space?
Yes, that's very fair. And a big influence who I should credit is Bill Bradford, who was Mike Hoy's former employer and friend. He was the publisher and editor of the magazine Liberty for a long time, which was a very influential libertarian glossy cover magazine with a lot of intellectual stuff in it. And I knew Bill in those days, and we used to all get together, you know, and share zines and things. And Bill and Mike had a giant falling out around 1990, and where Mike Hoy just renounced libertarianism completely, you know, and in the sense that he thought they were mostly sellouts to Republicans. And so he much more embraced anarchism after that time. And he published a lot of things attacking libertarians after 1990.
Did you guys also publish the Robert Anton Wilson essay, Natural Law or Don't Put a Rubber on Your Willy?
Yes, and also Principia Discordia was published, I think, first by Lumpanics. We've had a lot of sci-fi authors connected to the house, and Mike Hoy was a big sci-fi fan. So, but you know, we don't see too much sci-fi that's making it into the catalog. Unfortunately, we never put out too many of those manuscripts ourselves. But yes.
Last question I was going to ask you is, you've represented a lot of different people over your career. I think you told me Dr. Seuss and a few others, William Gibson. But I was really interested. You mentioned Ted Kaczynski. Could you talk a little bit about that at all?
Yeah, he published a book recently called Anti-Tech Revolution. How and why? I'm not sure the subtitle. I should remember it, but it's Anti-Tech Revolution. And his publisher contacted me about promoting it, and I did the PR campaign for it online. And another brilliant book by him, his first, you know, the manifesto that was published, the Unabomber, so-called Unabomber Manifesto. And that also, very brilliant scientific analysis in both of these things. The problem is you read it and you wonder, like, why did you kill people? It just doesn't even make sense. If you read his own works, it doesn't make sense that he attacked these people. And because by his own writings, it's not going to make any difference. And, you know, he basically sets out very brilliantly an Anti-Tech Revolution, which I highly recommend to everybody to read that book, how, why it is that countries, nation states must unleash corporations in order to survive, or they will be crushed by other nation states. But at the same time, when they unleash these corporations, they unleash their own doom, because these corporations will eventually become bigger and stronger than the nation state, and they will take it over, and they will run that. And you can see the inevitability of this in Ted's writings. Very, very clever. The one thing I noticed in Anti-Tech Revolution, though, is all the footnotes are like to Cambridge Analytica, or not the Cambridge Encyclopedia. So you can tell he's working out of a prison library. He doesn't have access to any of these books that we might have about technology today. So he's got very limited resources, and yet he still pulls off some quite beautiful scholarly work. So
I was going to say, I mean, the manifesto is really interesting. I feel like the first half of it sort of has this sort of like proto-alt-right thing going on. But then you get into the second half and there's this sort of sense of the problems have become too complex. I don't have all the answers for them. And I think it gets really interesting in the second half of the manifesto. And I do think people should read these materials, even if they don't agree with you know, what
it's not going to make you into a killer or anything to read them. And it doesn't justify what he did or apologize for it at all. He's a very intelligent person. I even dissed him a little bit in the Nashville article because I said that he might be a genius at math, but not so much at chemistry, because if he knew better chemistry, he would have been able to kill people much sooner with mail bombs.
Last thing, because I know I kept you a little bit over the hour here, but I just thought of it. So I know you've you defended sort of what Loon Panics has published, and I do think there is a case to be made for, you know, we need to protect the First Amendment and free speech, especially with all this big tech sort of censorship going on. And
wow.
I don't think it's just going on with targeting of the right. I think there's a lot of targeting of the left going on by big tech. How do you think, though, that federal agencies can deal with this issue of domestic terror in the age of the internet? That may be above your pay grade. I don't know.
Yeah. I tend to believe that it's going to be an increasingly smaller problem, partly because of the number of people with the skills and the psychology to execute significant events. Since 9/11, we have not had, as far as I can recall, anything, any substantial size of a terrorist attack. And of course, the guy in Las Vegas, the shooter there who killed so many people from his hotel room, is to me the example of the lethal lone wolf. And I really thought that that was as lethal as a lone wolf could get. I would hope never to find anybody more lethal than that guy out in Vegas. I mean, a lethal lone wolf, he was devastating, you know. And so he was certainly the most lethal lone wolf I could imagine until this bomb thing happened. And then I thought, well, gosh, if they could have done something like this, if people can do something like this, then I'm as scared even living in a small town in the country. I have to find out if there's any buildings like that in my town that can be turned into a bomb, and maybe keep a distance from them, or maybe see if the city council can check whether we have a problem here. That just really scared me, because I know people can be depressed and they can have moments in their lives where they think, you know, I'm just going to end it all and I'm going to go out big, you know. And I just think if they just hang in there like the rest of us, that they may find that they're the reasons that they're needed are not apparent to them at the moment. And they should just cool their heels and don't take anybody out with you. You know, I don't mind people taking themselves out. And that book, Let Me Die Before I Wake, is one that Loon Panics published before it became an international bestseller by Derek Humphrey about physician-assisted suicide. So we do believe that people should be able to take themselves out of the game if they want, but don't like to see anyone taking anyone else out of the game. And I actually think in our society, this is probably going to continue to decline, mostly because of surveillance, unfortunately. So, you know, if they hear everything, see everything, and the AI starts work kicking in, they're going to spot people before they act.
I was going to say the other aspect of this, I guess when I ask what can federal agencies do, given federal agencies' track records,
yes,
they may not be able to do much, because it seems like there's a lot of incompetence to go around. And it's interesting you mentioned the surveillance thing. I've told people, I actually think as we get more into a surveillance state, there's actually a possibility of more things like suicide bombings. Because I guess, you know, I think there will be people that they don't think they can get away with crimes. They feel hopeless and they're just going to go out with a bang, which is what terrifies me about the future.
Yeah, the going out with glory is unnerving, and that does appear to be what this national bomber did, and boy did he do it in style. And as little as I would like to maybe publicize how he did it, I'm very concerned about a sole individual having such explosive capabilities and escaping detection, essentially. And so I'm not terribly anti-surveillance. I mean, it's just a reality of how we live. And also, surveillance provides another method to mess with the man. Because one thing I've learned over the years is that all these very complex systems, they all have a similar problem, and that they don't know how to deal with bad data. And so if you just keep feeding them bad data, they eventually don't know what to do with it.
There's always an exploit.
Yep. sort of like Doctorow's latest book, Cory Doctorow's book, is about hacking appliances and such things. So I highly recommend Cory Doctorow for everyone.
Well, hey, Steve O'Keefe, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. I think this was a very fascinating and insightful conversation. How can my listeners keep up with what you're doing, and also Ora Bora?
Really, the best way to keep up with me is at steve-o'keefe.com, and that's S-T-E-V-E, my first name, a hyphen, and then my last name is O-K-E-E-F-E, steve-o'keefe.com, and that's got all my writings, and I am going to be writing more for Counterpunch now. I just submitted something about fecalnomics with them that I hope that will turn into a series on fecalnomics at Counterpunch, which is basically the science of bad decision making. And so I have some other irons in the fires out there. I hope people will keep up with me. And I want to thank you, JG, for having me on this show, because I've been relaxed because I realized that given the caliber of your guests, you know, this should be a no-brainer. I can't believe I'm on the same show as Ishmael Reed and Noam Chomsky and people like Wade Davis, who I admire so much. And so I felt very comfortable here with you today.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Steve O'Keefe, author of the Counterpunch Plus piece, The Nashville Bombing, More Than Meets the Eye. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Ted, Rats, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.